Hey, players, welcome back. This is going to be part three of Jeff Higgins and DEA Tales from Afghanistan. We had such a good time with him on the first two parts. We said, hey, let's bring him back for another episode. So you'll see part three is not going to be as long as our normal episodes, but we still got this packed with a lot of great stuff, a lot of great information. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, just a little bit of housekeeping. Head on over to Apple and Spotify. Hit those 5 stars. It really means a lot to us. Just check out what we're doing. Check out what other people are saying. Also, head on over to our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. That's where the link to Jeff's book is, and along with his website and Elaine's restaurant. So make sure you check that out. Follow us on that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go to Game of Crimes fans, type that in your Facebook search bar, and you will pull up our group run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato. She rules with the iron fist, with the velvet glove. Just come on and join. We've got, I think, over 1,000 people now in the group. We're pretty close to it. We have a lot of fun. We get a lot of ideas from you on stories and things to include in our small town police blotter, and also what we do over on Patreon. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. A lot of good stuff there, including 911, what's your emergency? We've got Q&A coming out this month as well. Also, we've got things like You Can't Make This Shit Up. We do our Narcometer review of some of the best movies out there, except the real stinker, Miami Vice, that Murphy pulled out. But he has since been redeemed. So we've got a lot of good stuff for you guys there. But again, dive in, enjoy this episode. This is part three. Part four will come out on Tuesday. So you guys sit back, get ready, set yourselves up, because you're going to enjoy these tales from Jeffrey James Higgins on his time in Afghanistan. Yes, right before we went live on the air, we were discussing how a DEA who retired, I think he was a senior DEA guy, now is the superintendent of the Kansas Highway Patrol, Eric Smith. Congratulations on realizing the true path of enlightenment. You know, I think that's good, don't you, Murph? That shows growth and potential that even you DEA agents can, you know, show every now and then.
It tells me that the Kansas Highway Patrol is lacking in leadership, and so they had to bring a former Fed in. That is terrible. Hey, congratulations, Eric. And troopers, I'm just kidding. I'm just busting on Morgan. Love you guys.
Yeah, you still need somebody to bring your ass gas and have changed your tire, you old man.
That's right. That's right. I wish I could. I should have pulled up my notes here before we started, because I could go with some trooper stuff. I've been researching. Yeah.
Well, let's re-invite. When we last had this discussion with our friend here, We realized we got into his stories, and it's like, you know what? There is just not enough time to get through all of this. And so we made a command decision, and that command decision was we were going to bring him back again. Jeffrey Higgins, author extraordinaire, former DEA and restaurateur extraordinaire too. And by the way, congrats, Murph. You didn't know this because you were on late. It is the 1-year anniversary for his restaurant.
Oh, congratulations, Jeff.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's my wife's restaurant, really. Calling me a restaurateur just doesn't sound right.
Hey, it's better than calling you an FBI agent, right? Okay, our bureau friends, I love you guys too. I'm just kidding.
What are you waiting for, Gordon Ramsay to come up and scream in your face down there?
We do a lot of the literary interviews there, so that's been a lot of fun. I run those, and I've interviewed probably over 50 authors at this point. I think we have 11 or 12 coming up in April. So it's fun. You know, it's really nice to bring in authors and give them a place where they can celebrate.
Well, and I'm going to give you kudos too. It's a good racket too, because you bring up 20, 30 people, and people got to eat, people got to drink. When I was up there for Mark Greeny, which is how we first met, that was a great crowd. How many people do you think we had there for that? I mean, cause you had that whole one side filled, and then the other side that I was in was pretty much filled. What did you think we had there?
Yeah, we had 50 who had RSVP'd, but we had rain blowing sideways that day. So I know that cut into it quite a bit. I think we had 20 something. And then I had my book launch for the Forever Game the next day, and we had over 50 for that. So yeah, it's nice. It's nice to bring in people. They get to see the restaurant, realize the food's good, and it's a nice place. But it just warms me to be able to do something for writers, you know, because it really is one of the hardest businesses out there. The chance of success is so small.
And politics aside, when you have a U.S. Senator fangirl, the author, like Senator Mark Warner did. He shows up, sat right behind me. I turned around and said, "Ooh, what's he doing here?" You even got the senator there. He was a huge fan of Mark Greaney.
Yeah, you know, and that's like that's one of the beauties of like being a writer too is, you know, I mean, I've interviewed people from across the political spectrum. I mean, literally on the opposite ends, right? But we all love story, you know, and we all love a good tale, and we come together over these things. And it's the same thing with the restaurant. I've had people ask me about my politics at the restaurant, you know, and my politics are, you know, I like to eat. Why don't we just focus on what brings us together? It seems
there
like
you go.
Anywhere you go, right? It's everything is divisive and people are drawing lines in the sand. And But you know, we're all Americans, and 90% of what we believe is in common. We just never tend to focus on that because it doesn't work for the media, right? They can't sell advertising if we're all agreeing on everything.
Well, it's and then if you get in there and you do go into the discussion, it's like, well, if you don't agree with me, now we're enemies. That's so far fetched from what we are here in the United States. It's okay to disagree. It's okay to have different opinions. That's what makes us different from the rest of the world, is we can express our opinions and we don't get our heads chopped off.
Yeah, and which people forget happens in most of the world, you know, and it's people get married to their opinions and they feel like their identity's wrapped up in these things they've said. And if they've said them for long enough, it's hard to be objective. And I got to tell you, I love it if I argue with somebody about something and they change my mind. To me, that's a huge win. Like I am happy to change my mind on a position if I either had the facts wrong or something I was saying was incorrect. So convince me, you know, but it's really hard to come into something like that objectively, but I'm always happy to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I've got a good friend of mine. We played in a band together. We served on a nonprofit. We are as far apart politically, maybe as you could be, but you know, when, you know, but people have lost the art of just having having a great discussion, disagreeing, and then say, "Hey, let's go have a beer." So when Donald Trump won, because he was a huge Hillary Clinton fan, I sent him a dozen black roses. I said, "Sucks to be you, pal." You know,
and then you lost your one friend.
I have two friends, down to one. Yeah, no. We do the same thing. We'll have great discussions. In fact, this nonprofit that I'm working on, the National Center for Open and Unsolved Cases, he's somebody I've tagged because he's a terrific attorney. And by the way, he's a little bit older than me. He was an intern for the Democrats on the Watergate Commission.
Wow.
But I'll tell you what, though. It's funny, though, because he puts politics aside. He has been the city attorney for the city of New Haven and some others. He represents the police department against all these different lawsuits and everything else. He goes to bat for the cops. He goes to bat to negotiate stuff. He goes to bat to defend them. So it's like, I told somebody, I said, politics aside, if I was in trouble, he'd be like somebody I'd want on my side representing me, because he literally does not. Politics stops at the door. He says, my job is to represent the city, to represent you. And he does a great job doing it. So yeah. How do we go down this rabbit hole? I think it all started. It all started when I told you Eric Smith was the superintendent of the Kansas Highway Patrol. He's finally realized the true path to enlightenment. And so we are happy to start this over. Hey, well, Jeff, when we finished last, that's what I was doing. I was looking for my quick notes here, which I don't have in front of me. But we had a couple stories we were talking about, and we only got through one of them. So here's a test for you. Do you remember which one it was?
I have no idea. That was some time ago. What were we talking about? Who are you guys? Where am I?
No, we were going to talk about. So one of them, and I'm going to butcher his name. Okay. Not, was it Hanji?
No.
Hanji.
Haji Bacho was one of the cases. I worked a few really interesting cases when I was in Afghanistan. You know, I'm so fortunate that DEA gave me that opportunity to be there and, you know, and try to go after high value targets and try to put a dent in some of these terrorist groups. That whole Pakistan, Afghanistan area has the highest concentration of terrorist groups in the world. You know, everybody's there. And it was an honor to be able to use DEA's techniques and adapt them from just drugs to going after terror groups.
Well, let's talk about that for just a second, because some of the pictures you sent, which I think one of them showed you in BDUs, you know, all jocked up and everything. Had I not known you were DEA, you would look like you were part of military operation as opposed to DEA. Was that part of what was on the cover of one of your books?
No. All my stuff has been fiction that's been published so far. I can tell you when DEA first went there, I mean, it was really just working on a shoestring. You know, I got there with John O'Rourke, who was a country attaché. There were two of us who were permanently assigned. Then we had TDY guys coming in a few at a time, and we had nothing. We had no equipment. You know, I think I told you guys last time about wrestling a suicide bomber, and there's a picture of me with the bomb.
Yep.
And everything that I have on came from someplace other than DEA at the time, because we just weren't equipped. I was borrowing an MP5 from DynCorp, and I had a ballistic vest that the Marine Anti-Terrorism Unit had given me, you know, like just like everything. We had nothing at the beginning, and it took us a long time to really understand what it was like to work in I mean, DEA works in austere environments all over the world, but to work in an actual war zone, you know, where there's a shooting war going on, is really a different kind of thing. And it poses a lot of challenges. And so when we first started there, it was a lot of, you know, just using local cars and, you know, putting on pacoles and local clothing and going out and doing surveillances and meetings and developing sources. And the longer we were there, the more we professionalized it and the more we were able to create some kind of structure. Like DEA stood up a national interdiction unit, the NIU, which was 100, 125, 150, something like that, of troops that we trained, and we brought in Blackwater as trainers to help us. And we were able to project power around the country using these guys and INLs, airships and support from the military. And then in 2006, we formed, 2005, we formed the FAST units, the Foreign Advisory Support Teams, which was DEA's foreign tactical team. So it's sort of like, it was like the snow cap that DEA used to do, right? In South America on steroids. It was that, but really beefed up. You know, we trained with the SEALs, we trained with special forces, we were supplied by DOD. And that's where like the BDUs and things you see, I don't remember what picture I sent you, but that they supplied us with the military, the training. I trained at Fort Benning, you know, and then we did regular training with different special forces units. And then we were embedded with them all over Afghanistan.
Well, I can tell you the picture I was talking about. I'm sorry, I confused it. I conflated it, as they said. It was actually on your about page on your website. It shows six of you guys, and there's a fire going in the background, and you're all in BDUs. I think that's you there in the front. Yeah, you got an M4.
Yeah, so that was in the Red Desert in Kandahar. And so it's right on the Pakistan border in southeastern Afghanistan. And the Taliban had hashish labs all over that part of the desert. And so we flew in, and that actually wasn't my case, but it was my team did it. And we were down there blowing up labs and arresting these Taliban guys. As part of that, we ended up doing the largest hashish seizure in history. I can't remember how big it was at the time, but it was, you know, hundreds of thousands of kilos.
Hey, before let's talk about that for a second, because here's what I'm interested in, because you're operating now, you're operating in Afghanistan, which for, you know, up until 2001, obviously was under the control of the Taliban for many years. It had gone from a very prosperous country, the Taliban, but it is so hard. I mean, I think about some of the stories that come out of there. It's so hard because people who are on your side one day flip and now they're on the other side the next day. You know, alliances were very tenuous, so to speak, and so was trust. I mean, how did you handle the issue of shifting alliances, you know, the ability to trust people, knowing that I assume that sometimes you guys were fed intel, hopefully you got onto early enough where it's kind of like, now this smells like an ambush, you know, we're being set up. I mean, how did you work through those issues, especially you, the gringo, being dropped into the middle of Afghanistan there?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, we couldn't even find the cops who were assigned to the Afghan counter-narcotics police. You know, we'd go to their building that was built by the West, Western dollars, and nobody would be there except for the one colonel who was in charge, you know. So it took us weeks and weeks just to get people to show up. And then we worked with the French and the Germans and other NATO partners who were there trying to do training and beef people up. And we took our role as operations, right? So we worked on developing source networks, and we worked on going out. We started really small. You know, we develop sources, we teach them how to run sources, and then we get intelligence that we developed ourselves, and then we'd hit like local, you know, drug traffickers, people in the Kabul area, just so they could learn how to hit a house, they could learn how to do some tactical movement, which was it was a long road. You know, I remember I was hitting someplace in the desert in eastern Afghanistan, maybe it was Konar, and we were hitting a compound once, and I threw flashbangs into a room. As soon as they went off, my whole team ran ran away. You know, they thought they were being shot at. You know, even teaching them the concept, like a Western concept of you know, criminal justice, I'd get questions like, you know, like, hey, we want to arrest this man. Okay, great. Why? Well, he's a drug trafficker and he's supporting the Taliban. Fantastic. That sounds like our kind of target. What evidence do we have? Well, everybody knows he's a drug trafficker. Yes, I know.
My cousin told me he was at the market and he heard this. Yes.
Yeah, but even that concept, right, that you actually have to have like objective evidence and we have to be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Like even that whole concept was so alien to people. It's like if everyone knew he was on the other team, then we should just go arrest him and lock him up because that's basically what happens during warlordism, you know, and that's what was happening in Afghanistan for a long time. So we started really small. We trained him up and then we gradually got bigger and bigger. When we formed the NIU, it gave us the ability to get around the country. At the beginning, we were just doing convoys because we didn't even have air support. Once we had the Hueys and we were able to put together bigger missions, we were able to go to more places and be a lot more effective. But I left, I was there for like 15, 16 months, something like that, with the Kabul country office as the assistant country attaché. And then I went to our FAST team training, and when the first teams deployed, I was there as the assistant country attaché, basically hosting them. And then my team deployed later that year. And I spent the next 5 years with FAST, and most of that time I spent living with special forces, where we'd have like, you know, our team would come in and we'd send two guys to the north, two guys to the east, two guys to the west, two guys to the south, and we just develop sources. And that's what DEA does so well. We know the human nature of intelligence, and we know how to infiltrate organizations, and we know how to vet information, and so we go into these places with nothing, and you know, and during a 4 month tour we'd come out with 30 sources, you know, and we were providing a really good high level intelligence to the military and to the intelligence services. You know, they'd come to us and say, hey, we're looking for this guy, you know, and within an hour I'd have a GPS location and a photo of him, you know, and so like that's just what DEA does.
Hey, well, let's roll that, or let's unpack that for a little bit. When you get dropped in, I think you joked last time, you said you could drop a guy on the moon and in 30 minutes he'd have a source, you know, figure out how to do something. How do you go about in that environment with that culture, that religion, considering, you know, that it's wartime? How did you go about getting people to say, I know if I give you, it's not like here in the US, sometimes you say, the guys are going to get me, you know, but over there, the threat of death is real. How do you get somebody to cooperate with you knowing that if the Taliban find out or, you know, some terrorist group finds out, not only is it retribution for them, it's retribution for their family.
Well, you know, it's getting your foot into an organization somehow. So initially I started working with finding police officers that I could work with, that I could trust, you know, district police chiefs, people that for whatever reason were at odds with the Taliban, who were willing to work with us and introduce us to people. And then, you know, because it's a tribal civilization over there, right? So you have these tribes and sub tribes and then clans within the tribes. And so if you get your foot into one of them, you can use whoever you have and however you're motivating him, you can use that source to bring in other people. And so it would just sort of snowball that way. You know, the money's a big motivator in one of the poorest countries on earth, you know, and I think when I was there, like initially in 2004, the average income was something like $300 or $200 a year, you know, like it's really a poor place. So money goes a long way. Other people, you know, that were threatened by the Taliban or had lost family to the Taliban, you know, there were other people. I had a police commander in the Chappahar district who'd worked with us quite a bit. And this guy was a real patriot. You know, he just believed in having like a free Afghanistan where people weren't under the boot of the Taliban, or I should say under the sandal of the Taliban, you know, and he was somebody who was willing to risk his own life to help us out. And we had a lot of police officers like that, but even within our ranks, you know, there were blue on blue attacks in the military. You know, you had to be careful. I mean, I almost got shot a couple times by my own guys. You know, but that could be attributed.
You mean DEA guys or Afghan guys?
Well, it depends on who you talk to.
Well, actually, that was one of my check marks you hit upon, because I wanted to talk about blue on blue, because we saw that happen. In fact, one of the highest ranking people was a general who was killed by an Afghan soldier over there. But you know, when you talk, the thing that strikes me, and I see this sometimes, I guess that Americans, we want freedom for other people, but man, you go into an area, it's like, it's, it's like dealing with an alcoholic, right? Having had family members go through that, it's like, if you want their sobriety more than they want their sobriety, it's not going to work, right? So if you want their freedom more than they want their freedom, if you want it more than they want it, I mean, that seemed to be a constant challenge that I heard from people all the time over when I was over in Pakistan talking with the Islamabad Capital Territory Police. I mean, I felt like, come on, guys, we're here trying to help you. You know, what is it you want for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking to Islamists, right, they want a strict Sharia law to rule everything. You're never going to get through to them. It's they're ideologically impenetrable. But if you're, you know, if you're talking about the average like Afghan citizen, I mean, they're talking about illiterate people, super poor. They, most of them, if you could pull them independently, were not really thrilled with the harsh treatment under the Taliban, and they were happy not to have that again. But even ideas like I was there for the first election. We were doing security for the first elections. I think that I want to say it was 2005. And, you know, but people would vote the way the village elder told them to vote, you know, like, because that's the idea of like individualism, property rights, you know, like these things don't really exist there when you're in a pure tribal culture. This is a culture that existed for tens of thousands of years. You know, it's about your family and your clan and then your tribe. And the idea of like a modern nation state is very alien in a lot of ways.
Well, that was pretty clear too when you looked at a lot of the way that U.S. like everything from special forces, the military, even the government tried to work with them. It's kind of like, I think our problem was we thought money would solve a lot of things. We threw a lot of money at it. We did a lot of reconstruction, but again, it goes back to, it's very hard to instill a democracy into a country. In fact, when they did their constitution, the first line of the constitution, you can look at the Afghan one or the Iraqi one, it says Sharia is the law of the land. No, so no matter what you do, it goes back to your point, Quranic law, you know, the Sharia is the law of the land. So it takes kind of away that issue of democracy. But I wanted to ask you one more thing, though, too. When you said you were assistant country attaché, so for our folks out there, you know, we know that the government goes through GS levels, you know, like 9, 10, 11, up to 15, and then you get into SES. Where were you at in terms of a GS level when you're an assistant country attaché?
So I was just the GS-13. I was the full-time agent, and then the GS-14, John O'Rourke, was the country attaché. So, you know, the ambassador in a country runs all U.S. personnel. And so all the agencies are under the ambassador ultimately, and the ambassador reports to the White House, right? And so John was in charge of DEA. When he wasn't there, I was the acting country attaché often. And then we started with two guys and a bunch of TDYers, and we ended up, I want to say, over 100 personnel at one point at the peak. You know, and we had the full INL air wing was in there, and we had all, you know, support and intelligence agents and special agents. And, you know, we had a really big footprint. We had offices all over the country. But, you know, that was really at its peak. But it was always a challenging and difficult place to work. But that's why, you know, DEA, like, some, I complain about it sometimes, but one of the things we do really well is our lack, you know, in a way, it's our lack of leadership, and it's our ability to allow agents to just go do the job. You know, so if you have a good group supervisor, a good ASAC, you know, or a good country attaché, and he's mission driven, you really, as an agent, can do what you want. You know, as long as you're doing the job, you can do what you want. And you don't really see that, and you don't see that in the FBI, right? You don't see that in bigger agencies that are more cumbersome bureaucracies. But DEA is very nimble, and it's always been about, you know, getting the job done. It's been about putting people in jail and fulfilling the mission.
That's an excellent way to report it as well, or just to describe it, because, you know, when Javier came out of Colombia, for all the things we did in Colombia from DEA, he got promoted to 14, which he was going to get anyway. I got a QSI, quality step increase. I got like seven of those throughout my career. Most of them, the other six, were for a whole lot less than spending 18 months getting shot at. You know what I mean?
Right.
But here he goes in as a brand new 14, and the first thing they do is bump him up to acting 15. He's a brand new first line supervisor, and they immediately bump him up to an acting second line supervisor. Now, he's qualified to do it because, you know, we all know we got to do our job. You don't bitch about it, but that's DEA. That's, you know, step up to the plate. If you'll step up to the plate, they'll give you the responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, people did things. And in a lot of ways, Afghanistan was a different animal because there were a lot of people who didn't think we belonged in an active war zone. There were a lot of people who were worried about the danger. You know, it was difficult. It was difficult. You know, we our first inspection, we got hammered, you know, because we didn't have the right files and the colored files and things. And
God forbid. I mean,
that's really important.
Drug Enforcement Administration. It should be Drug Administration Administration.
That's right.
At times.
You know, so we just, you know, I never even got some of the pay I was due, the extra pay I was due, just because of bureaucratic issues that we had. But, you know, in the end, we beefed up an office, it grew, we were really effective. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there were, you know, deployments where we'd get advance notice about attacks that were going to happen, and we'd rush out in the middle of the night and warn, you know, the French military or the Brits or whoever we were working with at the time. And, you know, we saved so many lives just doing that. And it's the guys who are working in the Kabul country office. It's the guys who were on the FAST teams, you know, it's the guys from the special operations division who are over there. Everyone was doing something, and you can work some domestic cases for a long time and they can be really effective, but over there you're literally saving lives, you know, because people are getting killed all the time. And it was really effective. It was the kind of thing where I was over there and I couldn't like just sit down and watch a movie on my laptop without feeling guilty. You know what I mean? We just worked around the clock all the time because it was literally, if you take a break, maybe somebody dies. And that sounds hyperbolic, but it's true. You know, and the sources we developed these huge sort networks, and we'd get calls in the middle of the night all the time. Translator banging on the door, you know, saying, "Oh, we just saw something, or we just got a call. The interpreter wants to talk to you." You know, and having to gear up and then go someplace and do something in the middle of the night. We did that stuff all the time, so it was very fulfilling, and I'm really fortunate to have had that opportunity.
It's also very exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, it was super exciting. I mean, I was shot at many, many times. I was shot at on my birthday. That was a good one.
That's a good memory.
Who'd you piss off this time?
I was thinking if I got killed, well, that would be a cool looking tombstone, right? It would only be the copy editing problem.
That's DEA sense of humor, ladies and gentlemen. It's sick.
I think that's cop humor too. It's like you make jokes about the darkest things. Hey, look, if I get killed on my birthday, we can save on the engraving on the tombstone, you know, born, die.
I was just telling Jeff before we started recording here and Morgan as well that I was just at the DEA Academy last week with New England College, and I've been supporting them for several years. They bring their criminal justice students to town, and their professors have this whole week long thing that they go through. And on Thursday nights, I come to the hotel and speak to them that evening. And Friday, we get them a tour through the DEA Academy. So ASAC Eric Lee was talking to them and giving them a tour through the hallways up there. And we got to a spot and they were asking questions. And he said, you know, they'd already been briefed on agents, analysts, diversion investigators. And they were asking questions. He said, look, the agent thing is not for everybody. I mean, you've got to be able to handle the excitement, the adrenaline rush, the danger that goes along with it, you know, and that's why we have these other positions, and certainly not a knock on the other positions, but they're not quite as much in danger, you know, in harm's way as the agents are. And the three counselors from the new class were standing next to me and we're all talking. I'm like, all they had to tell them is you got to have a screw loose to do the job of an agent. That's right. That's the criteria right there, the requirement.
Well, once again, the technology gremlins, this happened. So, Jeff, this happened last week or a couple weeks ago. We were doing a recording, just came out this week, with a guy named Adam Gamal. He's from the unit, the intelligence support activity, you know, the Army's most secretive unit. And we were going through that. And then all of a sudden, Murph just disappears. The power went out down there in Florida. I saw were three guys in balaclavas grabbing Murph, putting a bag over his head and snatching it.
I didn't know they could track me here.
Simple, they just looked for the new brand new pickup truck parked across the lawn. You know,
well, I had to park in another part of the parking lot. Connie's got her car here, so it's and you may hear kids in the background. We're still in a condo at the beach. This is our last week. We're heading home Friday, so just enjoying the last few days.
All right. So where we were at, I was just joking because you were talking about being down there at DEA. I said, with the new recruits, are they letting them know now that they have to carry a gun? Is that part of the standard brief?
It is. It is. It's, Jeff, you haven't heard me tell this, but Morgan has. When I went through the academy, we had this guy show up, and he was just a mountain of a man. He was a stud. He was a chemist by career. You know, a good-looking guy. I mean, he could have all the girls in the bar when you go in. And we'd been in class for just a few days. He's acing everything. And you know how it is. When you're going on a PT, he's leading the pack. And we go out on the range there for a few days. And then one day we come in and he's not there. And everybody's looking around and say, what happened to Joe Blow or whatever his name? I don't even remember his name now. And the instructors wouldn't tell you. But eventually one of the counselors told us the man didn't know that DEA agents carried weapons.
It's stunning, right? It's just,
so now. Part of the interview process, because when I was a supervisor, first and second line supervisor in Atlanta, as you bring these candidates in to do an interview with them, that's one of the required questions. Do you understand you'll be required to carry a weapon and you may have to use it to protect yourself and others?
When I was in New York and like it was I guess probably the late 90s, I was on a panel and I remember we had someone coming in there and you have the standard questions you're supposed to ask them. And the guy had been like a toy manufacturer or something. And I just got this feeling from him and I said, hey, do you know you might have to shoot somebody in this job? And he went, oh, I could never do that. And the whole panel, and the guy took me outside and he's like, you can't ask him that. I'm like, then what are we doing here if I can't ask him that? Like, I mean, he should know what the job is. You know, do you want to work with this guy? He's literally saying, under no circumstances could he pull the trigger. And you know, I'm like, yeah, that, you know.
You want him to be your partner? I don't think so.
No, exactly. I mean, nobody wants to shoot somebody, but sometimes you got to do it.
Right.
Sometimes people just invite you to do it. In fact, Murph, there's another sheriff down there in Florida, and I'm trying to think of what county it was, just came out with another video talking about there was like a home invasion, and it appears that somebody shot at the guy and he went run off, and they don't know who it was, but he's saying, hey, you know, if that's you, don't worry, you're not in any problem. You know, we prefer if you shoot people, you know, burglars, if people who break into your room. Saves the taxpayers a lot of money. He sounded like Grady Judd over there.
Sounds like Polk County.
Polk County. And it doesn't say, well, in fact, we prefer if you shoot them. It saves the taxpayers money. Anyway, how we got started on all of this goes back to the hashish arrest, because I said, let's unpack a little bit about this. And my first thing was talking about how do you get informants in a country like that. Well, let's talk about this huge hashish, because here is the contradiction, right? The Taliban, the kindler, gentler Taliban that was supposed to be Taliban 2.0, they're back to stoning women to death for adultery. That was just announced on the news today. They're going to go back to doing that. And considering that this gets you killed in other Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia, or even like if you import it into Singapore, I love on their customs declaration it used to have on there, if you import drugs, it's a death penalty offense. So tell us about this hashish takedown, because obviously narco-terrorism, that's not only Pablo Escobar, but that's, you know, Islamic groups like the Taliban, that's how they fund their operations. How do you go about doing an operation like that?
So that one was Operation Albatross, I believe, and that wasn't mine. It was Tom Marble is one of the agents in our group, and he was doing that and developing his own intelligence, because he was in the South and I was in the East, and we're all in different places. And we ended up using some military assets for that. I think they actually napalmed the drug sites, and we went in and did the bomb damage assessments afterwards.
But it just sounds like Apocalypse Now. I love the smell of fresh napalm in the morning.
No, it doesn't smell good. I can tell you that. We seized 262 tons of hashish.
Wow.
Like,
oh,
it was
my
a
gosh.
Lot. Yeah, it was a lot. It was the biggest.
What do you estimate the street value on that would have been?
I don't remember. I don't remember what the cost. I mean, I know like, you know, for heroin at the time, I remember that like you could get a kilo of heroin for like $2,500 in Afghanistan, and it was going for, you know, 70,000 to 90,000 in the US at the time. So, you know, the markup on all the drugs, it's a source country, you know, so the markup was just insane. But we did a lot. When I did a Operation Siege Engine, and that was with the SEALs and with Special Forces and with our FAST teams, and we ended up taking over a Taliban headquarters in Helmand and in Marja. It's like right at the crossroads in the center of the province. And up until that point in the war, we'd hit targets, and then the military would hit targets at night and then be out before daybreak, right? So, but we decided to hold it. So we hit this place, and then we held it for several days, and there were Taliban just streaming across the border from Pakistan trying to take it back. And we had, you know, B-2s flying out of Qatar to support us, and, you know, A-10s doing low gun runs. And I think the total number we killed was something like 67 Taliban during that operation, but it was like 3 or 4 days of just solid combat, you know, with them.
There's nothing like the sound of an A-10 and that, you know,
that is the best sound on earth when you're on the ground. I'm sure all the guys who were like in Vietnam can remember what that's like. But yeah, hearing those low runs and the bombs dropping close, and you know, we were inside the safe range for some of that stuff. We had a sniper who was tearing us up a bit, and they dropped a 2,000-pound bomb in pretty close to us, and you know, just almost took down the brick structure that we were shooting from.
Oh, geez.
And that one, I believe, was the biggest opium seizure in history. We did, can't remember. It was over 16,000 kilos of opium we seized. And,
wow.
And so this was the Taliban headquarters, right? So like it was like, picture a crossroads, and the drug bazaar was like half of it. And then the other half was all like Iranian weapons and suicide vests and, you know, and just every type of weapon that they were arming people. It was all coming right out of Iran with maps and all that. And we seized, you know, hundreds of kilos or thousands of kilos of heroin. I don't remember the exact numbers at the time, but that was just a huge drug seizure. That was something we did jointly with the military. But most of our stuff was developed with DEA sources, putting together cases and trying to do extraditions and, you know, doing like classic DEA drug cases, trying to develop the intelligence on who was in the organization and who was funding them and who were the weapons traffickers and, you know, who were the smuggling groups and et cetera, and then infiltrating them, developing evidence and either prosecuting them in Afghanistan or extraditing them.
And that's the difference for our listeners. That's the difference of law enforcement versus military. It's the same not only in Afghanistan where you were, Jeff, but where we were in Colombia and all around the world. We're not there to fight a war in a military sense. We're there to try to build prosecutable cases to stop drugs from coming into the United States. So it's like you said, a lot of people were not happy that we had DEA agents in a war zone. Well, I mean, it's the same in Colombia. It's the same in so many countries. We had Rick Rambo on here, who was down in St. Thomas, and he's got local mob groups coming in ready to attack his home. You know, and that's not an open, recognized war, but it's still a freaking war.
Well, some of those Jamaican gangs and posses or other stuff, I mean, it's the equivalent of a war zone. I was just talking to somebody who's an independent armored car operator in Jamaica. And I'll tell you what, God bless those guys down there, because he says in an average year, 5 to 6 of their drivers get killed.
Jeez. Yeah. One of the most dangerous jobs in the world, probably, or at least in Jamaica.
Down there it is, because if they don't do the same technology stuff we do here. Well, but let's go back to that for a little bit. You mentioned a couple things too. Let me dive in on that. We know that Iran was a huge problem, not only in Afghanistan, but in Iraq. And you were talking about getting some of the Iranian weapons. We know that they brought over things called EFPs, explosively formed penetrators, which were actually worse, more deadly than IEDs. What kind of things were you seeing from Iran, either directly or indirectly, that was affecting what you guys were doing there in Afghanistan?
I mean, we were getting all kinds of intelligence where they were setting up training camps in Iran right over the border from Afghanistan and training Taliban, training Haqqani people, training. I mean, there's every radical Islamic terror group was in that, operating in that region. And Iran was supplying them with money, with weapons, with direct training. And so is Pakistan, by the way. The ISI, you know, the ISID were the ones who created the Taliban in the first place. And they basically have several divisions that are all sort of stovepiped. And one of them is basically just the Taliban support team. And even Pakistan military intelligence was directly supporting operations. Like I'd have sources who were with them. I had sources who went through Al-Qaeda training. You know, I had sources into these people who are working with them, and they'd be present when there'd be, you know, military intelligence in Pakistan and ISID people in Afghanistan, either providing equipment or providing the expertise and helping them plan and direct attacks against U.S. troops. And it was so bad that when an attack would be really high profile and really successful, that was, the planned and directed by like ISI or military, Pakistan military intelligence, the Taliban commander who was in charge of that would go into hiding because he knew that if he was called back into Pakistan, they could kill him to prevent them from seeing the link to Pakistan. So I was getting that. I mean, I had sources who were in the Taliban, you know, who were guys who were in the fighting, who were providing information to us. We had a really clear picture about what was happening there, and it was incontrovertible. I mean, we had enough evidence to charge people, you know. So, you know, the problems we had in Afghanistan were numerous. You know, you mentioned like one earlier in trying to impose a democracy. One of our earliest problems was we were doing the Afghanization of the process. So we were letting them take control. We invaded the country. We should have just set it up the way we needed it to be set up. That would have been better for them instead of letting them take control. Then the military itself was so hampered. I mean, just like in Vietnam in a lot of ways, right? You know, like you had Laos, we had Pakistan, you know, and there were things you couldn't do in Pakistan. We had that for a long time. The U.S. military couldn't do night raids because they didn't.
I heard from some special operators, some other guys, the rules of engagement depends on where your foot stood, depending on whose ROE was ineffective. It's kind of like you got to have clear rules of engagement. You can't have some captain over here going, well, we're not going to do this. And some colonel goes over here, well, screw that. We're going to do that over here. Right. So that, I mean, it was the Vietnam problem too, because you micromanage the war from a, you know, a distant location like they were doing from the Pentagon.
Yeah, I mean, it was really restrictive. I mean, there was at one point I had a source up on this mountaintop where there was this, yeah, I won't mention the name, but there was a high level Taliban commander, and he was having a meeting of all the commanders in eastern Afghanistan. So I had this mountaintop fortress that he lived in, and it was filled with Taliban commanders, and we couldn't get permission for anybody to drop on it just because the guy's family, the terrorist who lived there, had his family present, you know. And it's like it's a war, you know what I mean? Like at some point, if you could decapitate most of the Taliban leadership in eastern Afghanistan in one mission, why not do that? But we constantly were worried about what the aftermath would look like in the PR and what that would look like instead of just executing the mission. And I know a lot of military guys who are super frustrated with that, you know, because they're risking their lives. And it made things much, much more difficult.
You know, I got to tell you this. So I did, after retiring, I did a DOD
job. Hold on,
job.
Murph. I see that vein in your head starting to go. You need to calm down.
I know. What you're saying fits in perfectly with what I'm getting ready to tell you. I did a DOD contract job for a year. And part of that, we went to MacDill down in Tampa, where the Special Operations Forces are commanded from. And I thought this is going to be a cool meeting because, you know, I've worked with some of these operators before and get to see some old friends. This was a room full of military and DOD attorneys. I mean, you just want to, it's a good thing we didn't have guns because I might have just put it in my mouth and eat the bullet that day. But for 2 days, we're sitting there listening to them pontificate over how to run a war. And they're talking about troops in action in Afghanistan under fire that are not allowed to, you know, you've got air support close by that can be there in less than 1 minute to support the troops on the ground, but they got to feed all the information back to the commanders at base, who then have to call the attorneys, who may have to call Washington or MacDill to talk to higher level attorneys to get permission or denial to bring in assistance while our guys on the ground are under fire. Now, how the hell do you win a war like that? There's nothing fluid about that whatsoever. And they openly admitted this could take 20 minutes. Well, when somebody's shooting at you, 20 minutes could feel like 2 days out there. It was one of the most outrageous things. I thought, man, and you know, you couldn't talk about it because it was classified at the time. And I'm not telling you any particulars other than just the general concept of what this bullshit meeting was all about. But I'm thinking, this is so indicative of the war on drugs, because there's never been a bigger misnomer than the war on that saying, the war on drugs. We've never, as a country, fully committed ourselves to fighting it. We throw a few people. We threw Jeff out there with some of the fast guys. They threw Javier and I down there after Pablo Escobar. We threw other guys down there to go after
Chris and Dave after the Cali cartel. Two guys constitute a war. I didn't know that.
It's, you know, I mean, it's like you hear the Marine Corps. You got a battle, send one Marine. Well, DEA, we sent two DEA guys. It's just outrageously ridiculous. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox now. Sorry.
No, I mean, you're right. The rules hamper us all the time. I can't tell you how many meetings I had where at the last minute Special Forces was like, we'd be geared up, like with the trucks ready to go, and Special Forces would get pulled. And then we'd have to decide, do we go by ourselves or what do we do? You know, and I can't. And usually the answer was yes. You know, usually we just went out with DEA with our local guys and did what we could. And, you know, if we got into a firefight, they promised they'd come, you know, that kind of thing. Because then there's Americans in danger and it was easier for them to get permission. But we constantly were fighting. And, you know, it's not the guys in the military. They all wanted to go. They all wanted to do their job. It's the rules and what's coming down from higher that was preventing them from doing it often.
Well, I had that discussion, Murph. I went out to, I told you, Jonna Mendez's book signing. So Jonna was a guest on here, episode 135, I believe, about her. She ended up retiring from CIA as chief of disguise. But we talked about kind of the culture, but you hit upon it there too, though, too, Jeff. Part of this is the culture of risk. We have a lot of people who are so risk averse, they think everything needs to go through legal to make a decision. And one of the lessons I learned in business after I got out of law enforcement, I was doing, you know, my last executive position, I was at Bell Labs, Alcatel-Lucent. And we had one particular attorney who thought he was going to dictate how we were going to go to market. And I said, you've got the relationship wrong here. You're an advisory role. You don't make the money. You're overhead. You're not profit. So you tell me what you think the risks are. It's a business decision now for me to accept that risk or reject the risk and move forward from there. And I think that's the CIA. I mean, there's some good people there, case officers there that are afraid to run operations. Why? Because we were just talking a little bit about this too in law enforcement. You start changing the rules, people don't want to engage you anymore. Why? Because nobody wants to risk being tried. You want to go to prison for doing your job. You want to be on the front page of a paper. I mean, we've changed this calculus to such an extreme. It's hard for people to be that risk taker and go out and do those things.
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes DEA special is, you know, like a lot of agencies tend to count like inputs, like in criminal justice theory, right? You have inputs and outputs and outcomes. And the inputs are the man hours and the money and the equipment and the things that you're putting in to accomplish something. The outputs are, you know, might be the arrests or they might be the seizures. And then the outcomes are how you've actually affected things, right? How have you affected what you're looking for? And like in Afghanistan, we were looking to take off high value targets. We were looking to hurt the enemy. And that was our outcome. We were looking, can we take money out of their pockets? Can we take their key personnel off the battlefield? And that's what DEA is always focused on. I mean, I'll tell you just real quick, like one of the first cases we did was in 2006, we'd been putting out information showing the linkage between drugs and terrorism since we first arrived, you know, and I told you, I think the last time we chatted about all the pushback and from the intelligence agencies and from everybody, but it was there. And based on that, Congress passed a 21-960A law, which is a narco-terrorism law. If people are, you know, using narcotic sales to further groups that are either terrorist groups or engage in acts of terrorism, we could charge them under this law. So in 2006, right after the law was passed, my team went to Afghanistan and one of our sources told us about a guy who was looking to bomb the Jalalabad airfield. It was later named Fob Fenty after a soldier who was killed. But you know, he was looking to rocket the field, and it happened all the time. I was there when we had suicide bombers detonate at the gates, and Taliban try to infiltrate. You know, we get shot at, we get mortared. I mean, that kind of thing happened all the time. So we identified this guy, and we're like, okay, is there? You know, we always ask, where's the drug nexus? Is he a drug nexus? But it was self defense. So we were going after this guy, and we learned he'd been an opium trader. He'd sold hundreds of kilos of opium as well, which is interesting, right? Because people always say the Taliban is against drugs and all this, and you know, but like this guy was in his own right a drug trafficker, but he was also a hardened Taliban member. You know, he's an ideologue and a Taliban member. He was both, which is kind of a unique category for him. But we did things the DEA way. So we developed intelligence. Then we developed sources. My partner and I would put on the local clothes and we'd drive out into these rural areas and we'd meet this guy and we wire him up and we'd send him in and we'd do recorded conversations, you know, and we would do it just like you do almost any other DEA case. Start start off with incriminating conversations about what he wanted to do. And he was acquiring these rockets to attack the base. So at one point we realized that it was an imminent attack. And so we had our source bring the rockets to us, and we met him out by this riverbed, and we loaded these rockets into a back of a pickup truck, my partner and I. And
oh, gee, how safe is that? Where's the operating plan for loading rockets into the back of a truck?
We'll get to it when we got time.
Well, I did a lot of operational plans after we did that.
They call that ex post facto planning. It's always successful that way too, by the way. Plan never goes bad that way.
100% success rate that way.
Hey, players, this is the end of part three. Part four is going to come out on Tuesday. In the meantime, head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars for us. It really means a lot to us. Share this with your friends as well. Also, head on over to gameofcrimespodcast.com, our website. That's where we've got the link to Jeff's book and his website, and a link to Elaine's restaurant. If you're ever in Alexandria, make sure you stop by there and participate in the fun and the book author events that come out during that time. Also, follow us on that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, type in Game of Crimes Fans into your Facebook search tool. Pull up our fan group administered by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, rules with the iron fist with the velvet glove. Got a lot of fun happening there. We get a lot of ideas, a lot of stories. So come on and join us there. Also, join us at patreon.com/gameofcrimes. We've got more content on there probably than we do on our free podcast, and we're adding people all the time. So come join us, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. All right, guys, hang on. Part 4 is coming out tomorrow.